parents and kids and teachers and individual schools who are truly seeing their lives and communities changed as a result of freedom in education.
I would argue that School Choice Week has been the most successful example of bringing together people together in a collaborative way, because we're not competing for research or funders. We all have picked a few days to highlight our own organization and what we do to improve opportunity for kids. So it becomes a very collaborative effort. So an example of that, so Reason works with School Choice Week. One of the things that we do is we try to use the Reason TV videos and journalism to highlight some of the opportunities for school choice. So obviously the Alabama School Choice Rally was an example of that. And I personally have built so many new relationships over the last 5 years with people all over the country because of these, working together on these events and working to film these events and working to tell these stories. So just last week, the Alabama Senate passed a new charter school law in the state of Alabama. And one of the reasons that Alabama was one of the states that we were working in is it's one of only 8 states in the United States that do not have charter school legislation, so they have no charter schools, and they really have almost no educational opportunities outside of homeschooling or parents private paying. They still have basically a monopoly of the education establishment, and so kids, disadvantaged kids, really don't have anywhere to go. And actually, in getting this charter school bill through the Senate, which it looks likely that it'll also pass through the House, and that it actually will go this year and they will have a charter school bill, but many of the folks that participated in the rally and some of the principals and parents that participated in the School Choice Week event were then the witnesses that went and testified about their own experiences working in schools with their own families in front of the Alabama Senate to get the bill passed. So this just shows, you know, that we're not just doing this to, you know, have beautiful yellow scarves and bring people together, but we actually are working to build coalitions for institutional change. And Alabama is an example of where that's actually working. We're gonna get the first charter school bill passed in the state. So now I'm gonna switch now and talk a little bit about, why do we want markets in education in the United States? What is the problem? So here we have the Robert E. Kennedy Community Schools, a new school in the last couple of years in Los Angeles that was built at the site of the old Ambassador Hotel for a bargain basement price of $578 million for one school in the United States. And the working theory in Los Angeles Unified seems to be that if you have $20 billion in bonds to have the largest public works financing program in the United States, and you build a lot of new schools that are really pretty and expensive, that children will learn. That seems to be the school district's working theory, as far as I can tell. Here's the teacher's lounge at the Robert Kennedy School. The working theory here seems to be that if you have an opulent, beautiful teacher's lounge, that teacher quality will improve and that kids will have good teachers. Here's the student theater for their high school productions at the Robert Kennedy School, one of the most expensive high school theaters that you will find in the nation. And so having really, another thing they have is they have a kitchen at this high school that would rival the Food Network, in which, you know, literally they're teaching kids to cook in facilities that are multi-million dollars. And as far as I can tell, Robert E. Kennedy High School does not actually have a Food Network show that would warrant the expense of the kitchens. So what about, so here is the deal. A little dirty secret about LA Unified is it's like Detroit and a lot of other urban areas. While they have had this $20 billion building program, they've lost about 200,000 kids to charter schools. So they have and actually closed older schools, but they've opened a lot of new schools in the district. And so they're really, they have lots of schools that are at 40% capacity or 50% capacity. And in actually when the Robert Kennedy School opened, they didn't actually know who would go to school there. And so they bid it out and they started five schools that co-share the building. And right now we're on a testing break in the state of California. It looks like we didn't have any test scores last year and we won't have them this year. And maybe by 2017 we will have sorted out our implementation of Common Core and we will have some data to look at about how students in California are doing. But right now, 2013 was our last year of test scores, and you can see the schools that occupy, and I say that ironically, the Robert F. Kennedy Community Schools, they all minus 27 points from one year to the next, minus 5, minus 12, minus 8, minus 17. The only school that is gaining in terms of student achievement on the state score that kind of aggregates all testing in a school is the New Open World Academy, which is like a frightening name for a school. But they are an elementary school, and one of the things we know about school reform is the most intractable and most difficult kids to raise their test scores are middle and high school, and it's relatively easy for a short time to have improvement with elementary school kids. So the elementary school kids at the school are doing okay. The Robert Kennedy School really signifies what's happened over the last few decades in the United States. So I'm committing some kind of a mortal sin by showing a slide from the Cato Institute at a recent weekend event. But Andrew Coulson, who is an education director there, he has done a lot of work to kind of quantify how we've been doing. And what you see, the blue line is the total cost of education, the first one going way up. In 1970, adjusted for inflation, it cost about $58,000 to send a kid for their lifetime of their K through 12 education every year. And in 2010, it cost about $165,000 for a lifetime of K through 12 education. The red line is how much staffing has gone up. Way more people work in the schools, the next one that's going up. The dotted line is how much enrollment has gone up since 1970. So you can see the red line with staffing has gone up a lot more than the enrollment line. So we have way more adults that we're paying to work with a relatively flat number of kids. And then the green and the red and the purplish line, that's all student achievement for 17-year-olds on the National Assessment of Education Progress. So we can see that we used to, in inflation-adjusted dollars, spend a lot less to get the exact same outcomes for 17-year-olds in terms of reading, math, and science. Similarly, this next slide is just federal spending. And the federal government used to give K through 12 a lot less money than they do now. And again, federal spending has shot through the ceiling, and all of those academic performance on the NAEP for 17-year-olds are still flat in reading, math, and science. So we've spent a lot of money. We haven't seen a lot of improvement. And that's basically why we want more competition, besides the fact that obviously we want parents to have choice and control their kids' destinies, and we want schools to look more like Pop-Tarts and less like the one plain, sad Pop-Tart with no frosting on it. Here we have how much we spend in the United States on K-12 education compared to the rest of the world. And really, we go along with Switzerland as the top spending of all developed countries, OECD. And so not only do we spend a lot and we spend a lot over time, we spend more than anyone else in the world on education. And this is kind of complicated, but basically what the OECD did is they tried to figure out, do nations like the United States that spend so much more actually perform better than other nations that spend less. And what they found is that countries that spend more than $100,000 for the lifetime of the kids' education, so remember, we're at about $165,000 in the United States, do they outscore other countries that spend about half of that? So Hungary, Poland, Estonia, they spend about 50% of what we do for the cumulative lifetime of a kid. And guess what? It turns out that there's top performers that spend less than us, and you don't get any added value for spending more than those countries that spend 50% of what we spend, if that makes sense. So if countries that are spending around $50,000 are performing the same as countries that are spending about $100,000. So we haven't internationally added value by spending so much more on education. So what if we have school choice and the money follows the child? What happens then? You know, is that a good thing? Should we do that? First, where are we at in terms of market share? So last time that we were here, we did not have 51 school choice programs that included private schools. So this includes 23 voucher programs, 18 tax credit programs, and two education savings accounts, which is the biggest new innovation in education choice that I'll talk about at the end. So we have about 300,000 kids that go to private voucher programs. Now that's not very many, considering how many kids are in public schools in the United States. But then when we move, and then we see over time that we've had a lot of growth in the number of kids in private school choice programs. But then when we move to charter schools, a lot of people think of charter schools as a more, less robust, more marginal school choice program. And they are regulated more than other kinds of schools, but in the end, charter schools actually do have the money follow the child, because if the kid doesn't enroll in the school, it works a lot like a voucher. It's just that they have to follow more regulation, and they also have to be authorized by the government, so they have to get permission to operate from the government. So we're always fighting for that permission, but they've grown by 6,700 public charter schools, 2.9 million kids, the newest figures, 5% of public schools. And a feature, not a bug, of charter schools is that when they underperform, they actually close. So last year, 200 charter schools were closed for low performance, financial difficulties, and low enrollment. And not one school in Compton Unified was closed, or in Harlem was closed. Part of National School Choice Week, we put together an infograph about charter schools. And one of the things that they do is they produce better results than traditional public schools for less money. So they get about 30% less funding as public schools than traditional public schools. And a study of the National Assessment of Education Progress found that for every $1,000 in school funds, they produced on average higher scores in both reading and math, 16 points in reading and 17 points in math for every, you know, that's not bad on a national test that everyone takes. They're also more diverse. You often hear that they cream or that somehow they are not representative of their communities or that they segregate kids. But when we look at them on the whole, they actually have more diversity than traditional public schools. They really work well for minority kids. Low-income blacks gain equivalent of 7.5 extra weeks of math instruction and 6.5 of reading. Low-income Hispanic students, 5 extra weeks and 3 extra weeks than traditional public schools. New Orleans, which we talked about the last time we met, on the last report of charter school market share, they had 91% of their kids enrolled in charter schools. And other cities like Washington, D.C., Cleveland, Detroit, Los Angeles, a huge number of kids competing with traditional public schools. And New Orleans is now at 100% because they just closed the last three traditional schools that were run by the Recovery School District. We can see that in 2005, when the charter school miracle started in New Orleans, 92 62% of the schools were failing. Now it's down to 5% on the same state metrics in New Orleans. So they've had a 92% reduction in failing schools. And that 5% is even less because those schools that were closed that are now charter schools would be in that 5%. They used to rank 67th out of 68 districts. In 2003, they had risen to 38%, which, you know, is a huge gain over 5 years in terms of, or more than 5 years, but in 8 years, basically, they've gained to the middle of the pack. And again, we're having a testing crisis in the United States where we don't have information after 2013 because of Common Core. So it's hard for us to say how things are going in Louisiana or anywhere moving forward. And then I'll just close with this school in Chicago. They sent 100% of students to college 5 years in a row. And this may, you know, we talk about the college bubble. We tend to get grumpy about it. But for students that will never have this opportunity, where charter schools are really excelling, they're doing okay for the same money with student achievement. But they have 20-point advantages in terms of high school graduation. Same with school voucher programs in Milwaukee. They have 20 or 30-point advantages in terms of college attainment. So these are long-term goals. I mean, a math score for a 17-year-old is important, but in the United States, going to college arguably gives you lifetime financial benefits. And then I'm just going to close with the newest form of school choice, and I know education savings accounts. Instead of the idea of school choice, we've moved to the idea of educational choice, where not only would you have school choice to go to a school, you just should have the money in a savings account where if you want a tutor, you need an occupational therapist, you want to get some downloaded classes from Stanford, you want to go half day at a private school, you could completely customize your child's education and you would have, and then the money you had left over would roll over into a savings account. And this can be funded through public school tuition, like a voucher, or it can be funded through a tax credit program, where the tax credit, which is completely private, goes into the education savings account, and companies may donate for low-income kids, and that goes into the education savings account. And then if their parents are efficient, they can then save the money and roll it over towards college from year to year if they don't spend the full amount of the education savings account. And so right now, Arizona and Florida are the only two states that have education savings accounts, but those in the blue and purplish, those are the states that either have current bills in the 2015 legislative session, or they are seriously considering filing bills towards education savings accounts. So school choice is winning. We've made a lot of progress just since 2011. And now Andrew is going to talk a little bit about the National School Choice Week campaign.
As Lisa has described, there really is right now an abundance of school choice across the country. And from where I sit and in my job, which I have to say is the best job in the entire world, because I get to help plan a series of awesome parties every year promoting school choice, and at the same time, help tell the stories of parents and kids and teachers and individual schools who are truly seeing their lives and communities changed as a result of freedom in education. And I think that if we look at the growth of school choice in America today, and also the demand for school choice in individual communities across the country, we have the potential to see right now in the next 5 to 10 years an exponential growth in the amount of school choice. And I think one of the reasons we're going to see that is, number one, we've reached a tipping point in terms of how many people are benefiting from school choice. Parents are seeing other parents actually being able to choose the right schools for their kids, as opposed to being stuck in some arbitrary zip code, mandated schools. That's number one. Number two, so many so-called reforms recently, whether it's testing, as Lisa talked about, with new standards, have really not been popular with parents. The new standards program has not been implemented as effectively as it could have been. And people, frankly, are really mad. They want more options. And school choice, in my view, and in the view, I hope, of many of you here, is the single catalytic reform. It's the reform giving parents freedom and opportunity. It's the reform that can get all other reforms done because it is the reform that parents understand. They understand that if they choose the right school for their child, great things will happen. It makes a lot more sense to individual parents in local communities than teacher quality reforms, standard reforms, testing reforms, spending reforms, things like that. Choice is truly the great equalizer. So with that, I want to talk about why National School Choice Week exists and how we play a role in this overall movement, because as much as I'd love to take credit for the growth in school choice, it has nothing to do with me, really. It has to do with individual parents and students. And School Choice Week came about because we recognized, folks recognized about 5 years ago, that there were three major barriers to the long-term systematic growth of the broader school choice movement. And that's not just private school choice, but in the public sector as well. So public school choice programs, charter schools, magnet schools, virtual schools, again, private school choice, vouchers, tax credits, homeschooling, all of those things. The three barriers that existed in the movement were, first of all, the movement focused far too much in the past on organizations at the national level, at the expense of state-level organizations and individual parents. The interests and views and needs of individual parents were often left behind, in favor of a more, I guess, high-minded policy discussion. Now, reason is a great exception to that rule. They're able to sell the policy of school choice in a much more effective way. The second thing I would say is that for too long, the school choice movement, which is really not, it has not been a real movement for that long of a period of time, because you have all these different sectors and factions within the movement, and they haven't been getting along. So getting folks to build coalitions and get along has been essential to the growth of this movement and the creation of an actual movement. And the third thing is that nobody within the school choice realm really wanted to do marketing. Everybody wanted to talk about policies and how do we create the best bill and how do we create the best model for implementation. But heck, if you don't sell something to the general public and to real parents in local communities and all you do is talk about it, I say this as I'm talking about it, you end up with a situation where people don't understand what you're trying to promote to them. So marketing has been something that the school choice movement did not do very well for a while. So a few years ago, 5 years ago, folks said, let's try to knock those barriers down, bring people together, start promoting school choice in an understandable, digestible, and in some cases, fun way. And National School Choice Week was born. And the goal of School Choice Week is really to empower parents and teachers and administrators in all different types of schools and outside of schools to hold events where they celebrate school choice where it exists and demand it where it does not during 1 week out of the year. And the goal is to start tens of thousands, if not millions, of individual conversations about educational freedom and then aggregate all of those stories into an effective national celebration. And we do that every year in January, and we're now, as Lisa said, in our fifth year. And we do have five key goals to School Choice Week. We want to increase public awareness and demand for school choice, so really letting parents know that they do have choices where they send their kids to school. And in many places, parents don't know the choices they have. So we're trying to let people know you do have choices in many cases, and then let them know also if you want more choices, like parents have in other areas, stand up, have your voices heard, speak out, contact your legislators, and demand greater options. We want to encourage the creation and the development of coalitions of school choice organizations, specifically in states. So bringing together these different sectors and factions, whether it's the open enrollment crowd in public schools, magnet schools, charter schools, the voucher proponents, the homeschooling advocates. Honestly, I've seen more fights within those five or six sectors than you do between the school choice crowd and the opposition. And we can't have that type of fighting. So we want to create these coalitions so that when it comes time to pass crucial legislation, folks are actually getting along. Strengthening bipartisan alliances is very important. So this isn't just viewed as a Republican issue, but an issue where it's safe for Democrats to come on board and prove to America that the school choice movement is actually a movement. And it isn't just people talking about this issue in very narrowly defined ways. So that's the goal of School Choice Week, or the five key goals of School Choice Week, and let's see how we've done over the last 5 years. So this year, we were able to work with folks all across the country to encourage the planning of more than 11,000 events across the country. We doubled the number of events from last year, and since 2011, we've grown from, as Lisa mentioned, 150 events, so pretty exciting to do that. And the one thing I wanted to mention about these events, and we'll talk about where these events come from and who's planning them and what they look like in a second, but the exciting part about School Choice Week is that these events are independently planned and independently funded, and we are really cautious about making sure that we don't tell people what they have to do. You can plan any type of event for School Choice Week that you want. It's almost like New Year's Eve. Everybody's celebrating it, but everybody has a different type of party. So people can plan rallies at schools, open houses, pep rallies. They can do a National School Choice Week flash dance. They can go to their state capitol and rally for change. They can contact their legislators. They can hold a carnival. We have people doing anything to raise awareness in their local communities. And by allowing people to do that and by saying, listen, we're not going to tell you what to do. You celebrate your own way. We're helping to create dialogues in local communities that help inform parents in those communities about what's available to them and what they could have if they had more options. So we have school participation, and this year 9,600 schools held events, everything from private schools to charter schools, magnet schools, traditional public schools, and online academies. We also work with organizations, everything from local chambers of commerce to business organizations to think tanks to school choice organizations, charter school associations, and encourage them to hold events throughout the year. Throughout the week. A lot of organizations don't usually plan events. They don't usually organize celebratory types of things, and it's been a struggle in many ways to get folks on board to do things, but we think we found the solution this year where we encourage folks to talk about school choice as part of an already planned meeting, and that's this My Meeting program we've created. So we had more than 500 groups across the country talking about school choice in their local communities during School Choice Week. Now, of these 11,000 events, I mentioned that they're all independently planned, independently funded, and they are really autonomous. We don't set too many rules. But there are some states where we work and try to help build really strong coalitions and help foster events so that these coalitions will plan their own events, but we'll provide some support. And this year we did that in the form of rally celebrations at state capitals. And you saw a video that Reason did about the event in Montgomery, Alabama, which was the biggest one this year with 5,000 participants. This year we worked in 15 different states with more than 100 different organizations in those states, bringing people together from all different sectors of school choice and education reform. And the goal, again, is not just to hold a celebratory event, but it's to bring people together who they might work in the same city and in the same state, but because they're on different factions, different sectors, they never go to each other's offices. And it's a lot easier to get them to sit down and plan an event and choose what type of rally sign they want and where they want to start the march or the rally at, or whether they want to give out bottled water or not, making little decisions like that than saying, okay, let's sit down and craft a piece of legislation. So you get people to start planning a party, they become friends, and they start working together year round. And I'll talk to you a little bit about some of the impact that we've seen from those coalitions. So very, very successful program, thanks to all those partners we worked with this year. We also have elected officials involved doing proclamations, and interestingly enough, we actually have more Democrats on the mayoral side doing proclamations recognizing School Choice Week, and more Republicans on the gubernatorial side. And for the first time ever this year, the U.S. Senate unanimously and with bipartisan support, when it came to a resolution being introduced, passed a resolution recognizing School Choice Week throughout the country. We have strong online outreach efforts because, again, we focus on individuals and what matters to individual families. And we saw, for example, more people search for school choice on Google during School Choice Week this year than at any other time during the last 5 years. So we know that of our goals, we're seeing the first two, increasing interest and increasing demand, go up sheerly by the amount of interest on Google. We also trended on Twitter, which is, I don't know how important that is, but it was fun. And one of the ways, we're number three after Bell, let's talk. I don't know what any of that is. But and another goal, one of the metrics that we use to figure out whether or not School Choice Week is successful is media coverage. And we want to, again, reach individual families in local communities. And we actually place a higher emphasis on local media coverage than we do national media coverage, which is something that I don't think many national level organizations do. And the reason we focus more on local media is because we think that individual parents will sit down around dinner time, watch the local news for either the weather or for a local sports team, something like that, and they'll say, you know what, this is something that we can talk about. We want school choice covered in a very local, individualized way. And local news coverage, we had 5,600 positive stories this year, and since the inception of School Choice Week, about 12 to 15,000 positive stories over the course of 5 years. So very exciting, reaching 140 million people. You can see some of the growth. We had the biggest growth in television news this year over last as a result of those capital events. And here's just some of the different screen caps of different news stories. And I want to mention as well, before we wrap up and talk about lessons learned, that when we're reaching local communities and we're building these coalitions and they're doing events, that these are having significant impact far after the week is over. The Alabama video was a great example. That charter school legislation looks on track to pass. In Arizona, there's a tax credit scholarship enhancement bill that has been proposed and promoted by the coalition that planned an event in Phoenix. In Idaho, which is the first time we've ever worked in Idaho, there's a big rally in Boise, and they're working on a charter school funding expansion legislation. In Nevada, Governor Sandoval is pushing as a result of, or as one result of, the rally there, the creation of a voucher or tax credit scholarship program. In Texas, there may just be private school choice for the first time ever, and there was a huge rally there during School Choice Week. So the examples are numerous, and I could go on and on and on, but the basic premise is we're building coalitions that will stick together, fight with each other, or to fight together instead of with each other, against each other, during the process of legislative session. So they end up getting along better and, you know, advancing a common goal. A few lessons that we've learned, and these go back to the barriers that we're trying to break down with School Choice Week, is that parents do deserve more of the spotlight when it comes to school choice. And this is something that we as folks in the movement need to make sure, is that the voice of local parents is essential, and we need to help tell their individual stories as opposed to the stories or the opinions of organization leaders, especially at the national level. School choice is a local issue. This is not a national issue. It has national importance, but it is a local issue that is decided at the state and local levels. There's not much the federal government can really do when it comes to school choice and education, and it's important to remember that as we fight for this common cause. And positive events that are fun in nature help build strong and lasting coalitions. And I just want to mention one thing, is that you see we have these yellow scarves. Some people say it's a gimmick. I think it's great marketing. We do a lot of things that people wouldn't ordinarily think a school choice organization should do, such as give out millions of yellow fleece scarves, create a video where kids can learn the moves to a dance. 2 years ago, we chartered a train and took it across the country in a whistle-stop tour. And yes, these things are marketing gimmicks, but they work because people are looking for things that are out of the box, interesting, eye-catching, you know, that they'll say, wait, what is that? And our goal is to captivate people's imagination, and we'll do anything we possibly can to do that in a positive, bright, colorful, interesting way. So by planning events with folks and building these coalitions and doing it in a fun way, we're having an impact. Actually, I should say those organizations are having an impact, and School Choice Week is really just the template that they, or the you know, blank piece of paper that they write on. And of course, the power of real marketing, using real marketing techniques and applying those marketing techniques to smart public policy, cannot be understated. And those are the takeaways that I think that we've learned from School Choice Week over the last 5 years that we'll continue to use to guide us in the future. And you know, I do think that if we remember these things, and if we remember what I try to tell people, that we in the school choice movement must never forget that we're really only as good as the stories we tell. And those stories are of the parents who are choosing great schools, regardless of the kind, for their kids. Their kids are succeeding, and communities are getting better as a result. And it's been an honor to help tell those stories, and I hope to continue to be able to do that and work with all of you in telling the stories of these parents who are, in my opinion, heroes. So thank you all so much.